Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the podcast that says me. Listen, they can't all be slam dunks, everyone. My name is Patrick Bromley. I am joined tonight by way of New York by Eric Asperschlager, who will be speaking in a British accent for the entire show.
Hello.
I laid that one on him as a surprise, everyone. He didn't know he would be speaking in a British accent.
No, when I do this show is the only time I'm not speaking in a British accent.
This is when you use your American accent?
Yeah, absolutely, mate.
It's very, very convincing.
Cowboy.
As always, you can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. And email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. And, of course, you can find us through DVD Verdict at dvdverdictpresents.com. And while you're there, visit DVD Verdict for tens of thousands of DVD and Blu-ray reviews, some of which are written by myself and Eric Asperschlager here.
Really kind of like, it's like 50-50 of the 10,000. I've done about whatever half of 10,000 is.
And I've done 10 of them.
Sorry, I'm not good with the maths.
No. Anyway, but check out DVD Verdict. For my money, the best DVD review site on the internet. Boom. There it is.
Wow, you said it.
I'm not taking it back.
You went there. I can't believe you went there.
Come fight me if you want.
This early.
Tonight.
Is this sweeps week or what?
It absolutely is sweeps week. Wow. Tonight we're talking about Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the 41st funniest movie ever made, according to some stupid poll that I already don't remember. But it was, I saw that it ranked number 41 of the funniest movies ever made. And I wonder what the other 40 are.
They're probably Caddyshack.
Where does Caddyshack 2 rank?
I don't know.
I'm going to guess it's number 42.
Probably.
And number 71, oddly enough. Before we talk about Monty Python and the Holy Grail, I want to remind everyone that we are currently in the midst of 30 Stars of Summer at F This Movie. Every day we're watching a new movie, hopefully, starring a different actor. You can find the calendar/list of actors at fthismovie.blogspot.com. And join in. You see who the actor is that day. You watch a movie hopefully you've never seen. You leave a short, possibly, review in the comments below and get involved in the discussion. That's gonna be
a heck of a thread when all is said and done.
No doubt. I wonder which actor will have the longest thread.
Probably, I can't remember any of the. I remember Jimmy Stewart because that. Sorry, that was the first one back when it started last week, and not tomorrow.
Oh man, remember when half of America was still standing a week ago?
Crazy time.
My, how things have changed since then. Who could have predicted what would happen in the last, I don't know, 5 days or so?
I mean,
you're
right. I mean, say it was May 31st.
Yeah.
Not the midst of June.
We would have no idea what was ahead of us.
Right. No, not at all.
Snow White and the Huntsman was not yet the top grossing film of all time.
Nor did it, top the Rotten Tomatoes chart of the best movies ever made, starring Charlize Theron.
I, for one, was surprised when the government mandated that every American see it.
Obama's America, am I right?
Hey,
I mean, I didn't expect them to make it part of Obamacare, but, you know. And also, Obama.
Have you seen anything good lately, Eric?
No, I have. I saw a couple old things last week. I mean, two weekends ago.
Old things aren't good.
They can be, right?
What?
Especially when you haven't seen them since the theater. On Memorial Day weekend, I had a little time to myself, so I treated myself, dipped back into the Blu-ray stack, things I bought but I hadn't watched. So I saw a couple things I hadn't seen since the theater.
Okay.
Both themed together. Okay. And in preparation for later this summer, a little mini Christopher Nolan marathon.
Nice.
With saw Inception and Batman Begins, neither of which I'd seen since they were in the theater.
All right. And what is your reaction to them with some distance?
They're good.
All right then. Moving on.
I watched Inception first, and I remember when I watched that in the theater, thinking that, you know, I can't wait to see this again. And of course, I waited a long time. I liked it a lot. I think it's watching it, you know, thinking back to when it was the big summer blockbuster of that year. Was it just last year?
2010? Was it 2010?
Okay, so it was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Right, that makes more sense. Yeah, I mean, and then comparing it to the you know, blockbuster we have this summer so far, which is Avengers, and they both do kind of similar things in that they're both these big, huge, complex movies that are trying to balance a lot, story-wise, character-wise, and so on. And I have to say, of the two, as much as I liked Avengers, I think Inception pulls it off a lot better. There's obviously a lot of exposition. I think Nolan handles it about as well as you can. Kind of in the same way that Avengers kind of handles that many superheroes and that big a threat on film as well as you can. I appreciate that Inception doesn't take some of the shortcuts that Avengers does at the end, and that it all kind of wraps up
right
in this kind of really impressively constructed package. I may have had some complaints when I first saw it, because I'm a complainer, that it was a little more structure than heart, I guess. I didn't have that reaction this time. I just kind of really, really enjoyed it, and kind of knowing where it was going didn't diminish my enjoyment of it. So go ahead.
No, I was going to ask if you have any theories or is there a specific way that you choose to read the film?
Yeah, well, I, you know, watching it, and I guess if you haven't seen Inception, sorry, but, watching it for most of the film, I was like, okay, yeah, this is definitely, all of this is happening in his dream. This is obviously just, you know, his wife was right. There was one more dream level they didn't go through. And if he could just, you know, if he just killed himself, he'd go through the next thing. But, you know, at the end, they're like, well, maybe not. I know there are enough kind of moments in the film. I think the one I think where they really stuck out to me, and the point at which I said, oh, this has to be true, is, you know, when he spins the top, mm-hmm. and is about to kill himself, and then the phone rings and it's his kids. Mm-hmm. It's a very kind of dreamlike thing to happen. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It could go either way. I swear the thing wobbles at the end, but does it wobble? I can't tell. Nolan! So.
Have you ever read the, back when it came out, I guess, 2 years ago, Devin Faraci was still writing for Chud at the time, and he wrote this long essay about how the movie is actually a metaphor for filmmaking. Have you ever read that?
No, although you probably talked about it on the show.
I might have. It's worth checking out if you have.
Okay.
Because I don't know necessarily that that's what Christopher Nolan was intending, but it's an interesting reading of the movie. He claims that the entire thing is a dream, that there's no part of it that is real, but that doesn't matter, that the whole thing is actually just Christopher Nolan's sort of comment on, homage to, whatever, on filmmaking.
Sure. I mean, you know, the fact that it's a film means it's not real.
Oh, so, good point. Also, you just shattered my reality, so thank you. I always assumed I was looking into a little window where real people were acting things out for me.
Look, come on. I don't need the sarcasm. All right.
That was not sarcasm.
Especially if you're not going to give it to me in a British accent. All right. I like Inception.
Yeah. It's okay. Just kidding. I love that movie.
It's a great movie. And it was nice seeing it on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
On the small screen. Although seeing it on the small screen, I realized how big of an impact it had on the big screen.
Yeah.
Especially that opening. Not quite the opening scene, but when he's in the building, Saito's building. Dream building, and it all starts collapsing and the water comes pouring in. Yeah. I remember being blown away by that in the theater, and it was still very impressive, but you know, maybe I just need a bigger TV.
there's your excuse. And how about Batman Begins?
I think that movie has, you know, since it's come out, it's really been overshadowed by Dark Knight. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have probably revised their opinions of it, maybe without even having seen it. Sorry, I'm distracted by your cup. What's on that cup?
That's Rowdy Roddy Piper, my
okay.
man.
Okay, that's what I thought.
It's
okay, anyway,
a giant cup with Rowdy Roddy Piper on it, all right?
Just kind of distract, you know. Anyway, So I really like Batman Begins. Like I said, I hadn't seen it since I saw it in the theater, and for no other reason than it just didn't happen. I don't know why. And I bought it when it was on sale. At the same time, I bought Dark Knight, and I've since gone back and rewatched that, but I hadn't had a chance to see Batman Begins, and I like it a lot. I think it doesn't. It's maybe not as striking as Dark Knight because it doesn't have as iconic, you know, a villain.
Right.
And they Nolan has to do so much kind of establishing the character, and the whole origin story happens there. Although I think he handles that, you know, very well too, kind of grounding Batman's training and then tying it into the eventual face off with either Ra's al Ghul, as the movie says, or Ra's al Ghul, as I've heard it from other people. So choose your pick.
Okay.
Pick your choice is what I was trying to say. there are things in the movie that I remember, you know, I've heard people kind of complain about over the years, like the actual kind of final bad guy plot to destroy Gotham is being kind of silly, but I thought it works, you know, in a comic book sort of way. I think that it has its own internal logic. I think that the Scarecrow works well. I think he's a good bad guy. He's maybe not, like I said, he's not as striking as the Joker, but he kind of fits into the reality of that movie well. And I didn't even mind Katie Holmes, so maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm just in a kinder, gentler place now. Or maybe I'm just, you know, saying, forget you, Internet. I don't like my own choice.
I think Batman Begins is problematic as a movie, even though I like it. And there's so many things that Christopher Nolan does well in that movie that you wouldn't have The Dark Knight without a lot of what he does in Batman Begins, which is place the character in a very sort of real world context. And that to me is always the problem with Ra's al Ghul's sort of ultimate plan involving the speeding train and the steam coming out of the sewers and all that, the gas rather, is that it is very comic booky, like you said, but the rest of the movie tries so hard to sort of distance itself from that kind of comic booky stuff that it's sort of at odds with the rest of the movie. It doesn't ruin the movie. I don't think it's that bad, but it does seem sort of at odds with the rest of the movie. And Katie Holmes, I always thought was fine. My problem there is that just she almost isn't needed. The character isn't almost needed in the movie, you know? And I think they figure out what to do with her a little more in The Dark Knight, you know? But
right.
And I guess she provides motivation for at least one of the characters in that movie. But again, her relationship to Batman is sort of this weird afterthought. And the thing I always liked about Batman Begins is one of the things that I always liked about the Batman comic books, which is that there isn't necessarily a singular villain, that there's all these different things coming at him from all these different angles. So you have Falcone, and you have the Scarecrow, and you have Ra's al Ghul, and you have just regular thugs. And the opening of Dark Knight sort of pays tribute to that, where you have all the Batman impersonators, and the Scarecrow shows up again. And I like that it suggests that Gotham City doesn't just have like one bad guy to deal with at a time, that there's a huge criminal element, and it comes in all these different forms. Obviously, having said that, I like the way that Dark Knight focuses all of that too. Mm-hmm. So we get sort of a different version of that. Where would you rank Batman Begins in terms of your favorite treatment, sort of Batman on film?
I put it at number two, just because I think Dark Knight is a better movie. Although, probably my biggest problem with Dark Knight, and it's probably sounds silly to say, my biggest problem is the character of Batman.
Okay.
He seems the most, in watching Dark Knight, anytime he has to just have a conversation with someone, he just seems so out of place. And when there's one scene where he's having a conversation with Gordon, and it's just, you know, how can you even understand what he's saying? I mean, this is not a conversation between people. This is just some guy growling in the corner.
Right.
Whereas I think for some reason, in Batman Begins, I thought the character made a lot more sense. And I don't know why. I think maybe he wasn't stylizing his voice to that extent.
Sure.
Maybe it's just the voice.
Okay.
I'm not the first person to complain about that, but So I guess I'll say number two.
I ask only because I know there's still a contingent of people that prefer the Tim Burton movies or that take on the character. To me, it's like sort of a foregone conclusion that Dark Knight's the best, and then Batman Begins is second, and then everything else comes after that. But I figured I would ask just in case.
Sure. I watching the movie again this time, I noticed how prominent Katie Holmes' nipples are at several points in the movie. They're very clearly visible through her shirt, which is distracting.
Sure. Interesting.
To me, and wow. perhaps Perhaps that's why she's there.
Or perhaps that's why she was replaced.
I can only assume that is a by callback.
Maggie Gyllenhaal's nipples are far more incognito.
I assume it's a callback to when Batman's suit had nipples on it. Now there's like, we'll take it off the suit, throw it on Katie Holmes, boom, you're done.
She's the little nod to the Joel Schumacher absolutely. Batman. Interesting. Yes,
either that or it's just, you know, it's cold in Gotham, and she's wearing very thin shirts. And the second thing I noticed is that in Batman Begins, there's a kid, and Batman sees him at one point, and he kind of represents. Yeah. And then later on, Katie Holmes, you know, kind of rescues him. That kid is Joffrey from Game of Thrones.
For real?
For real, that is.
I wish that, like, they would have let that kid die.
That is exactly. Batman had the chance to take him out when he was a kid.
Yeah.
It's like running into baby Hitler somewhere and saying, nah, go paint some stuff. You know, I mean, Batman.
Poor Joffrey. I mean, it's not the kid's fault that he's so good at playing that part that he's hated by all of America. And some parts of Canada. Do you think, in the same way that the playing card showing up at the end of Batman Begins is sort of a precursor to The Dark Knight, which, by the way, at the time, I was like, no, that doesn't mean that the Joker is going to be the villain in The Dark Knight. He would be crazy to go back and do the Joker again. They already did that. I was wrong in so many ways.
That's stupid.
My point is this. Do you think that Katie Holmes' protruding nipples is a weird way of foreshadowing that at some point Nolan is going to tackle Mr. Freeze?
We can only hope.
I don't know. He can finally answer the question, what killed the dinosaurs?
Could do that.
The Ice Age!
So you are, I think, like most people, looking forward to Dark Knight Rises. Am I correct?
I am, yeah.
How about that?
Yeah.
Do you have any reservations about it, or you just assume, okay, Nolan knows what he's doing, let's just see what he's got?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
I have reservations.
Me too. After rewatching both of these movies, it feels like, okay, this guy deserves a chance to do whatever he wants, whether I ultimately love it or hate it. It's his. He can do it. You know,
right.
It's his.
I do find it weird that there's this divide among sort of internet culture and fanboy culture, believe it or not, where you can sort of only like or support the Avengers or the Dark Knight Rises, where it's like, crazy. I like the Avengers. No, F that. Dark Knight will own Avengers. Like, well, let's wait till it comes out. I don't understand why it has to be one or the other, because I think the movies have very different goals, you know? Like,
yeah, I mean, I can't imagine more different universes than all of the Marvel films.
Yeah, right.
And then Christopher Nolan's take. I mean, there are things I like about each of them, and mm-hmm. there are things I don't like about each of them.
Right.
You know, I almost kind of wish Christopher Nolan could ground Batman more. I feel like he has created this world, and the Batman character is still such a, you know, iconic thing that ties back to the comic books. Sometimes to me, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I'd almost like to see what would happen if someone really tried to reinvent Batman and that's, you know, I'm sure people are angrily typing emails right now, but I'd be curious to see what would happen if someone really tried to do that. And maybe that's what, you know, that the Joss Whedon Batman that never happened would have been.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But who knows? So yeah, we'll see. Anyway.
All right. I'll talk quickly about two movies that I watched recently. You, sir, are a horror movie fan, correct?
I am.
Are you a fan of Dario Argento?
You know, I've never seen one of his movies. I've only seen his episode of Masters of Horror.
Which was Jennifer?
Jennifer, yeah.
Okay. I keep trying to like his movies, at least appreciate his movies more than I do, because I know there's a whole, you know, the horror genre is broken down into all these subgenres. And I'm not saying his movies are bad, although I am saying that some of his movies are bad. I just think, you know, in the way that certain, you know, there's rock music, right? And then there's all these different versions of rock music. And some of it is for me, and some of it is clearly not for me. And that's kind of how horror is. So I won't say that all of his movies are bad, but I just think that some of them are not for me. I rewatched, or not rewatched, watched for the first time, his most recent movie, I believe, which is called Giallo, starring Adrian Brody. It was made a couple years ago, and it was actually blocked from being released for a couple years. Adrian Brody filed a lawsuit, basically that he didn't get paid what he was owed. And so the movie couldn't come out for a while, and then they settled, and it's now available on Netflix Instant. And watching it, I felt like Adrian Brody should have sued because the movie is so terrible, and I feel like so damaging to him, his credibility as an actor. Because I watched it, and I thought they need to maybe take away his Oscar for The Pianist. Not for the he plays a dual role in the movie. See, he's a police investigator, and he's fine in the way that anybody playing a cop, with the exception of maybe Chris Klein, is, or Tracy Morgan. but then he also plays, under heavy makeup, the villain, who only goes by the name Giallo, because he has a weird skin pigmentation disorder that makes him yellow. See, it's a comment on the genre of Giallo movies, but also his skin is yellow. The bad things never stop. So he's wearing all these heavy prosthetics. He doesn't even go by his name. He goes by some weird anagram of the name Adrian Brody. I don't remember what it is, but he's credited as something else. The performance is so terrible. The movie is so badly made without any style. It's just so punishingly violent and silly. I just thought it was so amateurish and terrible. And it's one of these things where I feel like horror directors, more than any other kind of director, lose it at a certain point. It happened to Wes Craven. It happened to John Carpenter. It happened to Tobe Hooper. I mean, there are so many horror filmmakers that you can point to and say, hey, they did great work once. What happened? And I'm not even necessarily a fan of Dario Argento's earliest work, but I see what the appeal is, as opposed to something like Giallo, which I just thought was so terrible. And just to figure out, okay, this guy had it at some point, right? I went back and watched one of his early movies that I had never seen called Inferno, which is also available on Netflix Instant. And it's part of his Three Mothers trilogy, which was Suspiria and Inferno and then Mother of Tears, which came out a couple years ago and is also very, very terrible in the way that Giallo is terrible. And again, I didn't really like Inferno because it's just a series of characters being introduced and then being killed off very, very graphically. But I saw some of what I think are the hallmarks of an Argento film, which is sort of very stylized lighting, very stylized score, and this weird, there's almost no plot. The movie follows this weird logic that, again, appeals to a lot of people, that the movies are sort of structured like dreams, not in the way that like Inception is, but just in a way that things don't really follow into one another and characters appear and reappear. And, you know, that, I guess that's just not for me. Maybe I need more concrete plotting in movies. But so I didn't necessarily like Inferno, but I was able to step back and say, I understand how this appeals to someone. I did not feel that way about Giallo.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, dreamlike horror movies can work very well. Something like Audition.
Yes.
Yes. Audition, works because of that, because it's so creepy and so kind of off the wall. It's too bad. I mean, as you're describing your experience with Argento, it's like, are you describing an Italian John Carpenter? Because it sounds like, you know, I watched The Ward recently. That was terrible.
Oof.
And it sounds like it's the same kind of thing. They all got together and they said, okay, let's all just make terrible movies.
Yeah.
And see if anyone notices.
And I felt like, at least with The Ward, I don't know, there's something about the current Argento output that is off-putting to me, even more so than The Ward, because Argento's current movies will stop every once in a while to showcase some really horrible graphic violence, as though he thinks like, oh yeah, I need to put some of this in there, and that will, you know, it's sensational in a way that I think is ugly and kind of cynical. And at least The Ward stayed away from that. I mean, on the one hand, it's like, well, at least the Argento movies have that going for them, because The Ward doesn't even have that, but maybe there's something a little bit more a little classier about the ward. I don't know.
Well, that's something. I mean, the ward's pretty safe. It's just
safe is definitely by the numbers, boring and horrible. The whole subgenre of Italian horror movies, I keep going back to and trying to find sort of my way in, and every time I'm left cold. I don't know. I'll keep trying.
Yeah, I feel like I have avoided that just because my sense of it is that it's just so kind of disturbing.
Yeah.
That I don't want to, and that's just because it's an Italian. I mean,
you're the guy who still can't play Super Mario Brothers, correct?
Oh, come on. You just said the M word.
All right, so let's leave those movies behind, and let's talk about Monty Python and the Holy Grail, a movie that came about per your suggestion. So I will let you lead off the discussion in terms of...
Blame me.
Not blame. I'm just, what is it that brought you to wanting to do a show on Monty Python and the Holy Grail?
Well, it seemed like an interesting movie to do and a hard movie to do. And I guess we'll see how it goes. I think we can do it. But,
all right.
I mean, it's such a well-known, well-loved movie on the one hand. I mean, it's great. I mean, I think I've actually, since we took us so long to get this podcast going, I've actually seen it several times recently. But, I mean, it's a hilarious movie, very funny. Monty Python, absolutely, you know, really important to me when I was, you know, a teenager, kind of discovering them. Between them and like Douglas Adams and Mystery Science Theater, that kind of like was the core of my, you know, comedic development. So Monty Python, you know, great respect. I think that Holy Grail also kind of has this reputation that's derived more from the fans than from the movie itself. I mean, it's sort of become shorthand for the kind of nerd culture that many of us dislike on the internet. I mean, we all knew, or perhaps were for a short period part of the kids in high school who would quote the movie endlessly. I think it kind of shares some of Spinal Tap's not DNA, but I mean, it's the same kind of thing. It's another movie, right, highly quotable, that people who don't know better will quote for way too long. And so I think it doesn't have a negative reputation because of that, but I think a lot of people just sort of had sidelined it. And right. I don't know if people are going back and rewatching it on a regular basis. I think that it has sort of fallen out of favor, at least out of the top spot of what a lot of people would consider to be Monty Python's best movie. And we can talk about that later. I think that there's a lot to it. I think it's a very, very funny, very exciting movie that was done kind of just by the seat of their chainmail pants or whatever. I mean, it's got an interesting story. It's fun to watch. It's by great people.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. We'll see where we go from here. But that's kind of what I was thinking.
I came to the movie as a kid, because I had an older brother who was way into Monty Python. And, you know, my brother did not have the easiest time in high school, because I don't think he would mind me saying this. I don't even know that he listens to this podcast, but he was a geek before being a geek was cool. Now everybody's a geek. Everybody reads comics and goes to see the Avengers and loves everything. You know, geek, you know, the fanboys have sort of won the world. He was a geek in the 80s and watching Doctor Who and listening to Jethro Tull and playing Dungeons and Dragons every Saturday and obsessively quoting Monty Python. And I was, you know, younger than him, but he would put on this VHS tape of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and it was fascinating to me because so many things struck me as funny, but I didn't understand why, and they were funny in a way that I had never seen something be funny before. And at that age, it was very specific things. I didn't necessarily think the whole movie was funny, maybe because a lot of the jokes I didn't get, but I mean, I definitely remember thinking that the Black Knight was the funniest thing I had ever seen, because I had never seen all that blood and violence used comedically before, you know,
right.
Or the rabbit, the killer rabbit at the end of the movie was so funny to me because I had never seen an example of the dichotomy between this cute little rabbit and this horrible violence. And it struck me as funny. I didn't necessarily understand why, but at, you know, 8 or 9 years old, man, that was a hoot. And then there was a long time where I didn't see the movie, and I probably came back to it in high school, like you said. And I've always been a big fan of the movie. I do think it is their best movie and their funniest movie. I know there's a lot of people who would argue that Life of Brian actually is their best. And Life of Brian is, in a lot of ways, maybe more ambitious, if only because of the subject matter that it's taking on. But like you said, I would say Holy Grail is so ambitious just because they had no money. They had no resources. And it was one of those things that I didn't understand at the time. It's only in recent years watching that Almost the Truth documentary that we kind of talked about over email, or some of the special features on the DVD, that all of these choices that you think were just them being funny were made sort of as a result of not having the money to do better. The movie's opening credits has those great Swedish subtitles that are really funny. And that came out as a result of they didn't have money to do an opening title sequence. And they were smart enough to say, well, we still need jokes here. We still need to start the movie laughing. We can't just do white titles on black for 2.5 minutes. The movie should start funny. And so there's those great little Swedish subtitles that start the movie. And it's this weird little choice that if you didn't know was the result of budgetary restrictions, or the thing with the horses, you know, the movie is kind of famous for, rather than riding horses, they just pretend and a guy sits there and claps coconuts together. And that just came about because they couldn't afford horses, you know, that there's all these little things in the movie that the deeper you dig, the more you find out were choices made because they had their backs against the wall, not necessarily because they had complete artistic freedom, but it's those things that give the movie so much of its personality.
Yeah. Even down to, you know, originally, and I was listening to some of the audio commentaries,
Can I ask you a question real quick?
Yes.
When you listen to the audio commentary, are all the speakers mastered at completely different volumes, or was it an issue with my TV? I could only hear John Cleese.
That's possible. I was listening to it with headphones on, okay, so maybe okay. I could have all through. It was clear from like both of the audio commentaries that are on. I have the special edition DVD.
Yeah.
They just recorded everyone separately and then stitched it together. So that's clear. So that's probably why. They had all these grand ambitions for it, down to the locations. And one of the things they talk about is that they had all these locations, all these castles scouted in Scotland. They were all set to shoot at all these places. And then it came down to it that the Scottish government said, no, you can't shoot in any of our castles.
Yeah.
And then the other place they could find was someplace called Doon Castle, I think. So pretty much all of the castles in the movie are this one shot, one place, just shot from different angles. Or they're models up on a hill like 30 feet away, so it looks way farther away. There's a very funny joke where Terry Gilliam, you know, they're looking at Camelot and everyone's oppressed, and Terry Gilliam says, oh, it's only a model. And it's true. It's actually only a model. So all the stuff that they did, the fact that the chainmail that they wore wasn't, except for Graham Chapman, was just this kind of heavy knitted wool that was spray painted silver. Mm-hmm. You know, all these kind of really, you know, DIY things that give it a charm, but also kind of a cohesive look. In a way that's very different than the way most films have a cohesive look. It's not because they had all the money in the world to keep it all together. It's that this is all they had.
Right.
So, of course, it's in every shot.
Right.
So that's
cool. And I've never seen a comedy so willing to be so just gray and dirty and just grimy. I mean, it's really – obviously part of it, again, is that they had to use cheap film stock and they didn't have, you know, money to light things a specific way. But – part of that was an artistic choice, that everyone is just covered in mud, that there's no sunshine. And again, it's a comedy, which is an interesting
and there's a
choice.
And there's tons of smoke. I mean, they talk about that a lot, that they had this idea that they would just use smoke. And there are certain shots where it's just billowing in. And yeah, I never noticed it before, but the actors are almost kind of working against the sort of vision of – it wasn't really even a unified vision, because the film – actually, two directors. It was both Terry Jones and Terry Gilliam, who both kind of said, "Okay, we'll co-direct it." And I guess the way they described it in the commentary was, "This is the first movie they did themselves." So I assume, and now for something completely different, was
directed by an outside guy.
Okay,
I don't remember the guy's name, but yeah. And they were not really happy with that whole experience.
Sure, and that makes – I mean, it's, you know, it's just kind of nicer-looking – nicer-looking versions of the sketches that were already on their show. So this is – I mean, this is really them as a group trying to make it work. So you have these two guys, both named Terry, but that's really, you know, that's the only thing they probably had in common. Each kind of trying to coax something different out of the actors, trying to kind of make the movie look good, in, you know, in some ways maybe paying too much attention to the visuals while the actors were just trying to be funny. And so they're trying to do all these takes. It's just this kind of, I don't know, this kind of chaotic atmosphere that doesn't always come through on the screen, but I think gives them the energy to kind of create what they created. Like we said, right. Like a lot of it is kind of like their backs up against the wall, just dealing with the circumstances that they're, you know, that they're in.
Well, it's, you know, William Goldman always talks about how nobody knows anything, and whether or not a movie is good has nothing to do with the process of how the movie was made, because lots of terrible movies had easy shoots, lots of great movies had difficult shoots, and vice versa. But watching Holy Grail, I mean, it is impressive that the movie comes out as good as it is, and maybe it is the result of all these weird tensions and stuff, because it was a really unpleasant shoot by all accounts. Not just, you know, the weather and being out in the mud, but the members of the group themselves were not really getting along. There was a lot of conflict between Terry Jones and Terry Gilliam because, like you said, they each wanted different things. The Terry Gilliam was very interested in how the movie looked, which is why, you know, there are some really cool shots in it and stuff. And Terry Jones was more concerned with some of the acting and getting, I think, what John Cleese describes it as getting the joke on film.
Right.
Cleese tells a story about he did this one take that he was so happy with in the scene with him and Eric Idle, the Message for You, Sir. They were so happy with it, and they looked at Terry Gilliam, and he said, there wasn't enough smoke. And there were just there were fights all the time. Graham Chapman had, like, DTs because he was an alcoholic, and he was, like, sobering up and drunk on set all at the same time. I mean, there were all these – and, again, they had no money, which is amazing because what little money they had – correct me if I'm wrong – some of that came from – musicians, yes?
A lot of it, yeah.
Led Zeppelin kicked in some money, and Pink Floyd kicked in some money.
Elton John. And I think in the director commentary, Terry Jones and Terry Gilliam, they describe it as basically a tax shelter. At a time when the British government was charging, you know, the wealthiest citizens like 83% tax.
Yeah, rate. Wow.
So they were trying to find a way to kind of, you know, keep their money safe, so I guess they had like 10 big investors at £20,000 each. They had the $200,000, you know, and that would continue to some degree in Life of Brian, where it was almost entirely financed by George Harrison.
I know. I love the idea that like Monty Python was so beloved by sort of the British art community, or just, you know, England, that all of these wealthy rock stars would just be like, oh, sure, we'll pay for your movie because we want to see it. I mean, George Harrison has basically said, like, he kicked in all the money for Life of Brian because he wanted to see the movie, which is so great. I don't know. That's so great. It's a testament to how great they are, too.
Yeah, and then, I think that – you're right. That story kind of gives both movies you know, they feel kind of rock and roll.
That's an adjective
that I would want to use, and it's not usually is, but in this case, I will. It's there's such a anarchic spirit to it, and I think that the reason the movie works, and the reason Life of Brian works too, is because they're both so tightly written. I mean, I think the Monty Python, you know, from the TV show to the movies. What's great about them as a comedy troupe is that they have these sort of two sides. Kind of just playing off each other all the time. There's a very clever, educated, you know, verbose side playing off against this completely wacky, silly, just, you know, chaotic stuff. And the fact that they can kind of that the interplay between these two sides, which I think came, you know, a lot from the sort of splits between different personalities in the group and where they came from. I mean, they've described it as kind of the Oxford group versus the Cambridge, I think. But sort of two different sides, and the guy with the John Cleese and Graham Chapman on one. And you know, watching Holy Grail, there are those really silly, you know, silly, funny scenes like Black Knight, like The Rabbit. Mm-hmm. The things that, frankly, I think that the younger viewers, even, you know, high school kids catch on and quote endlessly, The Knights Who Say Me. But you know, you watch it later and you really, you know, I really love the constitutional peasant, you know, sequence,
yes,
you know,
yes.
That whole thing, which I think would go over a lot of younger viewers' heads, but yes. is just really so, so tightly, you know, written and so well constructed and so kind of silly in a proper English way that, you know, in a logical kind of illogical way that just, you know, works, you know, it just works so well. I think the fact that they, you know, it was a long writing process. They took a lot of time. I think at one point it was just going to be a series of sketches that had to do with the Holy Grail. And it wasn't until much later that they said, let's make Arthur, you know, the central character and keep it almost entirely, you know, in medieval times. I think originally they say in the commentaries it was going to end up that the Grail was going to be found at a counter at Herod's. Like at the Grail counter at Herod's. So they were going to go a whole different direction. The movie doesn't go there. You know, so they spent a lot of time writing it, you know, they say again in the commentaries that, you know, that there wasn't a lot of ad-libbing on, you know, on set. One of the few they talk about is during at the end of the Bring Out Your Dead sequence when Eric Idle says, "You can tell that's a king. How can you tell? Because he's not covered in shit." I mean, like, and that was one of the few kind of ad-lib, very funny line. But you know, they really kind of stuck to the script. They'd worked together for so long, they knew it was funny that as long as they could get it on film,
right?
It was going to work.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I think that's, you know, that's why it worked so well.
One of the things that I've always liked about Monty Python, and I'm not necessarily like a diehard Monty Python fan. I'm certainly a fan, but I'm not as well versed in especially their sketch show as a lot of people are. I probably know them best from the movies, honestly. Is sort of what you're describing, because I think there's a lot of comedy, even classic comedy, that falls into that camp of, hey, they'll do anything for a laugh, and there's highbrow and lowbrow, but it almost takes turns. I mean, even The Simpsons is guilty of this sometimes, and I love The Simpsons, but here's a highbrow joke, and then here's a lowbrow joke. And the thing that's great about Monty Python is that those things coexist almost at every moment, mm-hmm. that it doesn't separate into individual beats, that it's both things at once all the time. And I don't necessarily mean lowbrow in terms of like poop jokes or whatever, but just more sort of absurdist gorilla hands turning a page, like, and they don't call attention to it. It's just, hey, and then there's gorilla hands. And that is super funny to me. And along the lines of what you were saying about, you know, the older you get, the sort of new scenes and jokes that you appreciate. The two lines that struck me as funny for the first time ever this viewing were, one is when Galahad goes to visit the castle and the woman introduces herself and he says, "I'm Sir Galahad the Chaste," or whatever, and her response is, "I'm Zoot, just Zoot." I don't know why that's so funny to me.
It's funny, it is very funny.
And then also Terry Jones during the great witch sequence, and that's the one that, you know, that they're talking about something absurd, but the language that they're using and the logic that they're employing is so weirdly intellectual, and it's so funny to me. But they finish the whole discussion about whether or not she's a witch, and he says, "I shall use my largest scales." I don't know why this is so funny, because it implies that he has different size scales, and then you get to the one that's so comically large that the woman can sit on it. I will use my largest scales, to me, really made me laugh this time. Great. A lot of, you know, sketch groups have tried the jump to feature films, and I don't think any have ever had remotely the success that Monty Python has, specifically with Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And part of that, I think, is because they end up trying to do too much of almost a narrative movie. You look at Kids in the Hall, Brain Candy, which has things that are really funny in it, but I don't think works as a movie. Or Mr. Show did Run, Ronnie, Run, which even they have distanced themselves from, and they admit, hey, that's not funny. There are little pieces of sketch ideas in there, but they're trying to basically tell one story. And Holy Grail does that, but it very cleverly is broken up into sketches. I mm-hmm. mean, and like you said, that was sort of originally how it was going to be designed. But they work this overall sort of narrative into it, even though the narrative is essentially we have to find the Grail. I mean, the number of times that Grand Chapman says, like, where is the Grail? It's just this reminder that, like, oh, right, there is a story being told.
Right,
here,
exactly.
As sort of this through line. But I think it's very – the construction of the movie is very clever because it gives you all these little sketches and vignettes, but you're never super aware of just how episodic it is, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Would you this is a going back to what you're saying about sketch groups and movies, would you consider Wet Hot American Summer to be a state movie?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I think I would. And that I think is a very successful one. I really love that movie. But
sorry, I just wanted to say you're wrong. But
no, absolutely. I didn't say no sketch group has made it.
I think you did. I mean, I have to go back and listen to it. Just rewind 30 seconds, everybody.
All right.
No. And it's, you know, it strikes me in watching Holy Grail just how, you know, there is that episodic structure, but it's not like every single sketch is the same length. There's some that are just quick. There's some just like one, like a side. And there are these extended sequences. And when, you know, watching it now, I think probably my favorite part of the movie, my favorite kind of sketch, I guess, the movie, is John Cleese sitting with the Sir Lancelot section when he goes and breaks up the wedding. That whole thing with you know, Terry Jones as Herbert, the the albino kid, and then Michael, his dad, and the huge tracts of land and all that stuff.
The guards. Watching that sequence this time, you know, a couple weeks ago, or probably months ago at this point, we did a podcast on Braveheart, and I was criticizing Braveheart for the portrayal of Patrick McGoohan, the king, and his homosexual son, and that the homosexuality is just played for laughs, and Patrick McGoohan is so obviously ashamed of his son, and blah, 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 and how that homophobia creeps into the movie itself. And this movie takes essentially the same premise, although I don't think they make Terry Jones a homosexual character. And what I liked about it was that it's taking that same idea, but rather than go for the easy joke, which is that the father is ashamed that the son is is gay, that they go with this idea that the son is in a musical, that he's not in this medieval historical epic, that the son is in a musical, and Michael Palin keeps trying to get him back on track. I just really like, it's just an example of, they don't go for the obvious joke. They veer just this much to the left and find something more original and more clever.
Yeah, and that whole sequence is kind of broken up into its own mini sketches. You have the interaction between Michael Palin and Terry Jones in the tower. You have the guards, the brilliant guards coming in with the flowers on their helmets. And anyone else? Just me. Just you. Get back.
And every time you hear Terry Jones calling to John Cleese from outside the tower, it's funny every single time.
And I love the whole message for you, sir. Part with the arrow and the, I can come with you if you want. No, stay here. I shall avenge you.
Right. This recurring joke too of like, I'm getting better, that everyone who's wounded to the point of dying, starts to improve, but that gets in the way of the story that these guys are trying to tell. So they keep trying to ignore the fact that everyone is getting better. That's a great running joke, as is, of course, Runaway. I love every time they yell Runaway.
Get on with it. Keeps coming back. it's great because there are these little touchstones throughout that remind you you're in this, you know, overall movie that fits together. But they're just, you know, it's just a really, it's just speaking of, you know, well-constructed movies, I mean, I don't know, who knows how much of it came together in editing. I think they wrote, you know, probably wrote it, you know, so carefully that it came together, but it's just, it works for these little individual moments, individual pieces, and then just kind of all together. So
it definitely does a lot of these sort of, like self-aware meta jokes, for lack of a better word, where it breaks the fourth wall. And a lot of times that bums me out in a comedy because it feels like a cheat, I don't necessarily like when characters look to the camera, and like Michael Palin doing it in the scene we were just talking about where he stops the musical number. It's fine. It's not the funniest thing to me. It doesn't offend me. You know, the animator having a heart attack, and that's how they resolve the whole monster sequence, or even the end of the movie, that the movie doesn't really resolve as a whole. It's just broken up by the cops. none of that stuff, none of it is my favorite stuff in the movie, but none of it takes me out of the movie. I think they do a really good job of those, constructing those kinds of jokes. And I know that's, you know, a lot of what they were known for on their sketch show. When I was watching it this time, honestly, very early on, I actually started to get bummed out because I think the coconut thing is so funny. And then in the first couple minutes, they call attention to it. And I thought, oh, man, I forgot that right away they call attention to the fact that you don't have a horse. That's a guy doing coconuts. But and then all of that was wiped away seconds later by the great conversation about where do you get coconuts right. and whether or not a swallow could carry coconuts. And I just love the fact that they're willing to go down these paths where characters debate the weirdest stuff using such sound logic. You know, it's sure. it's that scene with the peasants too.
Yeah, and they call attention to it, you know, early on, and then later on, like when they're outside the cave with the rabbit, and it's like, oh, the horses are getting spooked, and it's just the guys with the coconuts kind of freaking out. I mean, that kind of stuff is great because it just plays off each other. It plays off so well. Now, I did not remember, maybe this was added to the DVD later. I do not remember the movie starting with Dentist on the Job. Has that always been there?
The DVD? Oh, what? No.
Did you see it?
Do we have a different DVD? I mean,
when I started DVDs. The movie, I said, you know, play the movie.
Yeah.
And it starts with the wrong movie.
No, mine does not do that.
Oh.
Mine just starts with the opening title.
Oh, okay. So there's this whole thing where it starts with a whole, like, this kind of upbeat British comedy. And it's got this black and white, these titles, and it's called Dentist on the Job. And there's all this, like, toothpaste all over the place. And the projector says, oh, it's the wrong movie, and then swaps it out. It seems like it was obviously added later because the commentary does not start until that is over.
Okay.
That's the first time I'd seen it, and so I don't know.
Well, God bless Monty Python for still trying to be funny years after the fact and saying, hey, we'll add one more joke on to this DVD to give maybe people value who have bought it six times. I mean, this is one of those movies, this and, you know, Army of Darkness and Evil Dead, and there's a couple movies that just keep getting put out in new editions, and I'm sure it's because, you know, it's a great seller for Sony, I think, is who puts this one out. So there's all these different versions of the movie. So at least they said, hey, if we're going to put it out again, let's add this little joke at the beginning, you know?
Yeah. I didn't remember seeing that. And there are other things they, I guess, added back in. There is a part during the Castle Anthrax sequence where Connie Booth addresses the audience and asks if the scene should be cut.
That was the version I watched.
Okay. And that, I guess, was originally cut out and was just restored.
And there's an example of sort of a breaking the fourth wall joke that I don't really think works.
Yeah, I think that maybe works better in a British context because that kind of harkens to the whole pantomime theater thing in England.
Okay.
If you're familiar with it.
Yeah.
And I've never actually seen a pantomime show, but my understanding is that around Christmas time, there's this thing. Everyone goes to the theater, and there are all these actors dressed in crazy outfits on stage, and it's a little bawdy, but that's okay because it's Christmas. and there's a lot of call and response with the audience, and the oh no he didn't. And there's usually, I think that's, you know, it's kind of like when you know, Tinkerbell dies and they have to get the audience to clap. So there is this tradition of asking the audience to get a response. So to me it feels like it's okay. It relates to that.
Okay.
So I'm just saying, I mean, obviously, born in England, you can tell by the British accent, I normally do.
Well, you're disguising
after the show.
Now. Right, exactly.
I'm like, kind of like Bob Hoskins.
I always find it odd when the subject of Monty Python comes up, and you rarely will get somebody who's sort of indifferent on Monty Python. It's sort of, yeah, I love it, or no, I don't like them at all. And often the logic behind that is – it's too British. That and I understand that there is sort of a different sense of humor, sensibility that the British especially had. I don't know that it's as true anymore, but certainly at that time, that British comedy was different than American comedy. I think a lot of the erasure of that line is thanks to Monty Python coming to America, but I don't think there's anything, and you, of course, just proved me wrong, but I was watching the movie saying, like, boy, I don't feel like there's anything particularly British about the humor in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, with the exception of the fact that it's about the legend of King Arthur, you know, which is not so much an American legend, but I feel like the humor is pretty universal.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, there are things in the TV show that are way more specifically British. I mean, they, you know, have like a pantomime horse will show up right. as a character in a sketch, or they reference Biggles, which I guess is something. Which is also referenced by Jethro Tull, and think it's a brick because I listen to Jethro Tull because I was also a geek. I still listen to him from time to time. But, you know, there's a lot of that, that kind of stuff. A lot of stuff about the Queen and
right,
all these
just Parliament sort of jokes. Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. And, yeah, you're right. You're right. You don't get that in Holy Grail. I mean, there is a kind of British stiff upper lip sensibility to some of what happens in Holy Grail. And that's part of the juxtaposition between kind of the highbrow, lowbrow.
Well, and I feel like the idea of the movie is sort of taking the piss out of that whole. I mean, Graham Chapman's whole attitude through the whole movie is constantly undermined. That he's sort of the stiff upper lip king who's constantly being undermined, not just by incompetence, but by his own cowardice or any of the situations that they find him in. You have to give it to Graham Chapman, who I think is really funny in the movie. And, you know, while he got the lead, and I think it's because they all sort of agree that he was the best actor of the bunch, he doesn't get to be as quote-unquote funny as everybody else. I mean, he plays a few little side parts. For the most part, he's just Arthur, and he's sort of the movie's straight man. I think he's still funny because of the whole pose that he sort of takes through the whole movie, that all of this crazy stuff is happening around him and he's remaining steadfastly straight. So I do think he's funny, but he doesn't get to be as outwardly outrageous and funny and play all these wacky characters that everybody else gets to play. Having said that, do you have a favorite performance in the movie or a favorite member of Python? I mean, I feel like anytime they come up, it's the same way with the Beatles, like who's your favorite Beatle?
Sure,
who's your favorite member of Monty Python? Before I ask you, I should tell you, I don't know that I have an answer because mine keeps changing.
I don't, I mean, they're all so different. I mean, I'll say Michael Palin just because I met him once.
Oh, cool.
Well, he signed a book for me at a book signing.
Okay.
So it's not like, you know, I went round his flat for tea.
Was this the diaries or whatever?
No. This was in 97. I think it was maybe the first of his travel.
Oh, okay. Got it. So
it was from that period.
Sure.
But boy, everyone does something so well. I mean, John Cleese is such the kind of, it's not a stiff upper lip thing, but very kind of like the erudite, educated, type. And I think, you know, the whole thing is with Lancelot just slaughtering all the wedding guests is great. I can give part of it to Michael Palin because he reads the Book of Armaments from the Holy Hand Grenade part, which is very funny. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I mean they all kind of pull their weight. I mean, even, you know, Terry Gilliam was not kind of way out in front and was not, you know, a visible member really during the TV show. He plays a lot more parts than I kind of remembered him playing. I mean, they're all kind of little things. He's either Patsy or he's the old man at the bridge or whatever. But I don't know. All right, fine. You, who do you like?
No, I'm in the same boat because, there are guys who consistently – I mean, Michael Palin makes me laugh in almost everything. Like when I think back to the show, he almost always makes me laugh as well. But so does John Cleese. And John Cleese is so good at playing – an asshole, for lack of a better word. And right. You kind of get the sense, especially watching that Almost the Truth, or if you do any reading about them, he's really good at playing an asshole because he was kind of an asshole.
Sure. Like,
I think he was the most difficult to get along with, and just the most difficult, period.
Yeah.
Even one of the producers talks about there was a lot of complaining, mostly John. And honestly, I would never have guessed like Terry Jones as being one of the funniest in the movie, but almost everything he does in the movie really makes me laugh, especially the voice that he adopts as Sir, what's his name? I just think it's so, I think his knight character is so funny.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably
I think he is the funniest knight. He's certainly the one with the most kind of personality.
Yeah.
Eric Idle doesn't get a whole lot to do with Sir Robin except, you know, run away. Although the Sir Robin song is pretty great.
Oh, I thought of another. I thought of another line that made me laugh. I'm sorry. It's Eric Idle. It's Eric Idle. The whole. I don't love the Knights of Nice sequence. I don't love the whole shrubbery thing. But to me, it perhaps gave birth to this whole movement where like a weird concept is funny just because it's kind of weird. And so the fact that they want a shrubbery, that's absurd. And so therefore it's funny. It gave birth to like Napoleon Dynamite. And I'm not crazy about that. However,
it's not blame Monty Python. Monty Python. You got to blame a lot of things on Monty Python.
Yeah, well, for sure. Well, the rest of it's called credit. This is the only thing that we can blame. But it does allow for the great Eric Idle line. I'm a shrubber, Roger the Shrubber. Roger the Shrubber makes me laugh really hard. They couldn't have picked a better name than Roger.
I love, speaking of lines that you love, I love, back to the wedding scene, because I just love it so much. Yeah. You know, during the Message for You, Sir part, before he goes in, and he's looking for the right word, and he comes up with an idiom, Conquered, I guess, is his page who gets shot. Says, idiom, sir, idiom. And then later, after he's killed all the wedding guests, after Michael Palin has cut the bed sheets and let Terry Jones fall to his near death, not death, he repeats it again, saying, oh, I get a little carried away when I'm in my idiom or something like that. He goes back, he uses it again. I love that he just calls back the word he didn't know that he had to be told
by
his dying page.
I do think, and I've always thought, that the movie runs out of gas in like the last 15 minutes, even before it throws up its hands and just says, all right, it's over. Here's the cops. I think everything after basically the rabbit sequence feels a little bit like padding.
Yeah. Is the rabbit sequence and then the bridge?
Oh, does the bridge? I'm sorry. Everything after the bridge. You're right. I forgot about the bridge.
I mean, after the bridge is pretty much just the French castle.
There's just a couple minutes, but you just feel like, oh, this probably should have been over already. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of get to the top of the mountain, literally and figuratively, and then you kind of go down, and it's kind of clear then they're never actually going to find a grail. They're just going to kind of be taunted by the French. And that's probably one of the things that people quote the most, and that's probably one of my least favorite parts.
Yeah.
Oh, the movie just probably, I know it so well, or knew it so well, that both of the kind of French sequences kind of leave me cold a little bit. But I like, and I didn't realize until I rewatched it how there is that through line sort of story of the historian getting killed and then the cops looking for evidence and then
right.
paying off the end. I think that works pretty well. I mean, it's a cop out, literally. but it's
There's some attempt to like plant the seeds throughout the movie, and they keep going back to it. And honestly, when they first ride through and kill the historian, that's funny. I'm not somebody who's above finding sudden, shocking bursts of violence funny, and I think they are in the movie. And again, the degree to which they go to making things really violent and really bloody is funny just as a visual gag, but also again as a way of making fun of or sort of taking the piss out of these historical epics, that it's this joke about how true they're being to the brutality of the time and the way that we have to portray things the way they were, and so things were just violent and bloody, but again they go so far with it that it becomes completely comical. I love that joke about the movie.
Sure, and it gives it the sense that this isn't actually happening in medieval times. This is basically a bunch of except they gave birth to LARPing. This movie, but it's gone too far. They killed a guy. Like Patton Oswalt's character in Reno 911. It's this guy who slice someone's throat because they ate the last slice of pizza or something.
So again, I didn't look at the list of the other 40 funniest movies of all time. And again, this was named by give me one second. Oh, it's Bravo. I mean, who cares?
Bravo.
Bravo named it one of the 41st funniest movie of all time. Total Film Magazine voted it the fifth greatest comedy of all time.
Did Total Film Magazine, are they the ones who put Life of Brian at number one?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, they're, I remember reading one. I was like, I think I agree with you that Life of Brian is nowhere near as – it's not as funny as Holy Grail. I think I think it maybe holds together a little bit more as a cohesive movie.
Yeah.
So maybe it's better, but I mean, Holy Grail is a lot funnier.
And again, maybe some of that is just due to the fact that after Holy Grail, they said, okay, we're not doing this two-director nonsense anymore.
Sure.
And Terry Jones became the director of – you know, the sole director of their next movies. And maybe it's just the result of sort of a more cohesive, singular vision.
Yeah, there's that. I think it's also a movie where the sketches last a lot longer.
Yeah.
There aren't a lot of kind of quick moments. So something like Michael Palin as Caesar in the throne room talking about biggest diggus. And this kind of goes on and on. It's funny, but at some point it sort of almost becomes a Saturday Night Live sketch.
Right.
Where it's kind of just, you know, let's cut it off and get to something.
I mean, I would never necessarily consider Monty Python and the Holy Grail one of my favorite comedies. You know, if somebody asked, I don't think it would pop into my head. And yet, as I watch it, I mean, it is consistently incredibly funny and smart and inventive. And I mean, I really have no complaints about it. And it's odd because I feel like you kind of said during your introduction that the movie is ghettoized a little bit by there are people who write it off because of who its fans are, because of the way that it's been embraced by a certain segment of the population. I think there's a lot of people who just don't have the patience for it. And that's a shame because it's such a funny movie.
Sure. I mean, it's also so, ubiquitous is probably the wrong word, but I mean, I knew it so well at a certain time. I watched it so many times that I didn't think to go back and I mean, I haven't. It's the first time I'd seen it in a decade or more.
Yeah, me too.
Because I've seen it so many times and I kind of know it so well. But even thinking that, I saw new things this time, or just kind of for things that I'd forgotten about. So I think there's a lot to rediscover in the movie, even if you've seen it a ton. I mean, it's kind of like when I was on for my favorite movies podcast and we talked about This is Spinal Tap.
Mm-hmm.
Same kind of thing. I watched that so much for a certain time in my life that in that case, it was kind of hard to go back and rewatch it because I knew it so well.
Right.
And I didn't discover a lot of new things in it the way that I did with The Holy Grail.
It's interesting because I think, the movie is still being discovered by new fans. I used to work at a high school. My wife teaches at a high school, and you can kind of tell who the kids are that discovered Monty Python. And I tend to think that this movie is sort of the inroad for most teenagers into finding Monty Python. They find Holy Grail first. And the reaction is always sort of similar to what I think my brother had in the 1980s and I had as a 9-year-old kid or whatever watching it with him. Even I think for today's teenagers who see Holy Grail for the first time is they think they've stumbled upon this weird secret.
Right, right.
And maybe it's because the other kids in high school aren't talking about Monty Python and the Holy Grail, but it's this thing that they see and then they want to talk to you like, are you aware of this thing where the guy gets his arm cut off and he says it's just a flesh wound. It's the funniest thing that everyone feels like they are the ones discovering it.
Yeah, and it is sort of that. I think if you are familiar with Monty Python and have kind of been with them for a while, it is that entry point. It's kind of like this. It's almost like a greatest hits album.
Yeah,
and you want to go for like the deep cuts from that point on. It's like someone saying, "I just heard this great song. It's called Stairway to Heaven, and it's just have you heard that? It's that kind of thing where it's a great song.
Yeah,
but I've heard it so many times. It's like Sergeant Pepper and something. That's a great album. Have you heard this? It's the same. Again, a great album, but I've heard it so many times.
Right.
I want to go in and find all the – I want to go to the White Album. And,
well, but that's why it's fascinating, too, that Life of Brian is next because, to sort of use the analogy that you're talking about, I mean, it's like going from – like the jump from like Rubber Soul to Sgt. Pepper or something, which, I mean, the Beatles essentially did. There was like one album in between there. But
Revolver?
Yeah, no, I know.
Oh, my goodness. Patrick Bromley.
But that the next movie requires so much more sort of work on the part of the viewer that it's a far less accessible movie. So it's just interesting that, somebody discovers Monty Python and the Holy Grail. This is so funny. I love it. I want to see what they did next. And then you get to Life of Brian and it's kind of like, what is this? This requires more work. I have to see this more times than I did Holy Grail, if that makes sense.
And it's weird because then they went to Meaning of Life, which I'm not really that crazy about.
It feels like a step backwards. I mean, again, totally. I think that movie is only still talked about because of the fat guy sequence, you know.
And I don't even think that's funny.
Nobody talks about anything else from the movie. Right. It feels more like, and now for something completely different, almost.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, I started with Monty Python watching the TV show, so that's kind of – so I was kind of way into that first. I would – there are books that collect the scripts from the TV show. Mm-hmm. I would read those semi-obsessively. So
really?
I am / was a giant nerd. Way into Monty Python.
Well,
so,
good.
Yeah.
The next time you come on, you get you can do the entire parrot sketch for us.
I can't anymore. You know, I'm getting old.
Well, listen, brush up on your chops and your British accent, your natural accent is what I'm saying, because
sure.
People need to hear what you sound like for real. Thanks everybody for listening to us talk about Monty Python. Don't forget to join in on 30 Stars of Summer. Sadly, no Python members included. Maybe next year we'll stick John Cleese in there or something, but we'll see. I don't know. But thanks very much. Remember, you can always email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, Eric. Good suggestion. I think we did okay. Do you have any final words?
Get on with it.